Hello and welcome to Holand Village. Today is Monday, August 25th. Today's session is entitled Jesus as the Proclaimer of Good News to the Poor, Session 1 of For the Healing of the World, Good News to the Poor in Luke, a Bible study with Walter Pilgrim, number PIW 2003-01. Let's listen in.
I guess we might as well begin. I'm glad to be here at the Old Village. I have been about six times. I have been at Holden for other conferences, normally with the clergy. According to the staff, those clergy conferences have been the toughest that they've had, you know, behavior-wise. But apart from that, I've enjoyed it very much. So it's good to be back here, part of the teaching faculty at home. I have taught at PLU many years. I retired recently after about 30 years of teaching. My area is, as you may be able to guess, the New Testament. My favorite gospel happens to be the Gospel of Luke. And the book of Acts, I did my dissertation of that, and some publishing in that. So I was pleased that what I saw for the healing of the world and this beautiful Lucan text there, wow, that's just what I want to talk about. So that's really why I've had the chance, I think, to come here and to be a part of it. I'm sure pleased that the Holden Village here has carried through on this For the Healing of the World theme. And you're going to hear it, I'm sure, often this week. And I'm trying to spin off of that by working on Luke and Good News to the Poor. I wrote a book on it. I'm totally shameless in publishing my book. Unfortunately, it's out of print. So, no sales that are going to have to go for this week. But still, when I wrote this book, I had two questions in mind. You'll see how I'm really trying to concentrate on those two questions. One is, who are the poor? And what's the good news? Just stick stubbornly to those two questions. Who are the poor in Luke? And what is the good news? And that gets us in some real good conversations with the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts. So I'm going to try to share a bunch of my the results of my thinking in that particular area. You all have Bibles? Okay. So I think let's, and you can see me here, okay. And some of the things that I wrote on here, it's an outline that will probably be of some help to you. Well, who is Luke? I don't have time to give you the normal introduction to Luke, but he is the one and only early historian of the church. He's the one who has two volumes. One is dedicated to the story of Jesus, the Gospel of Luke, and the other is the Book of Acts. Fortunately, we had that Book of Acts. Without that, we would be much at loss about what happened in the early church. But we have Luke, thankfully, who gave us the story of Jesus and the story of the church. And he ties it together with introductions to both his first volume in Luke and his second volume in the Book of Acts. He also dedicates it to someone, Theophilus. We don't really know if that's a real person or not. It's such a beautiful name, Theophilus. What does it mean?
Love of God.
God, lover of God, philos, love, theos, God, in Greek. So it could be just a pseudonym, but most of us think it was a real person that whom he is writing. So now we're in touch with Luke, the historian and the theologian of the early church. Whether he was a medical doctor or not, that's been the long-standing thought, but There are many good reasons for not knowing with any certainty whether that's true or not. Now, the text I want to deal with right away is Luke 4, 16 to 30, which some of you may know by heart, and maybe some of you don't know it quite so well. So we're going to spend a little time on Luke 4, 16 to 30. Everyone agreed that Luke 4, 16 to 30 is the theme text in Luke Acts. This is the passage which Luke is using to introduce us to Jesus and to the early church. Okay? And he's trying to tell us through this text that Jesus is the Spirit-anointed proclaimer of good news to the poor. And in this text here, you have the story of Jesus preaching in the synagogue at Nazareth, his hometown, and then his rejection. Now, where does Luke get this text from? In Mark and Matthew, you also have it. But it's later in the ministry of Jesus. Much later. So we think Luke found this in Mark. We were quite sure Luke was using Mark. We think he found it in Mark. Then he wanted to bring it up to the first of his gospel, to make it the theme of his gospel. And then he adds this quotation from Isaiah 61:1-2 and 58:4, and then tells us who this Jesus is that he is now trying to introduce his readers to. So, yes, Luke had this, found this in Mark, but he now makes it his text here in Luke 4. Now, we don't, I think, have to read it, but let me just go through the story here of Luke 4, 16 to 30. Again, it's in the synagogue in his hometown of Nazareth. We are told Jesus worships as you customary on Sabbath in the synagogues, so that's what we find him doing. Then he's asked to read the scripture and to give a brief homily on the reading. Rabbis and honored guests were often asked to do that. So I'm sure Jesus is a rather well-known teacher now, is asked to read the scripture and to give a brief homily on his reading. When you do that, you stand to read. But unlike our setting, you sit to do the teaching, the preaching, or whatever. Then the scroll is unrolled to Isaiah 61:1-2. And there's a little another passage in there for chapter 58, verse 6 in Isaiah. So it's sort of combined here. We don't know if Luke combined it or whoever combined it or not. But here's the question. Who chose this text? Some commentators argued that there was a lectionary just like we have, a selected text for each Sabbath day. So it's possible that maybe that's what Jesus was reading. Possible. Or the other is that Jesus wanted to read that text. So he had the scroll unrolled to that particular text. And so he reads it. And after he's done reading this text, and the text is right before you, he has the scroll rolled up. He has it to the attendant called Kazin in Hebrew. And he sits down to teach. Now, here's where the scene gets very dramatic. The eyes of everyone are fixed on this Jesus. They knew him as a prophet. They knew him as a teacher. And then Jesus makes a bold claim. Today, the scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. In other words, I am fulfilling this scripture in your midst. Well, the response is interesting here. It quickly moves from acceptance, yeah, you know, this hometown boy. Gracious words are used here. If you read that text, it means, okay, up to that point. But then, it quickly moves to questions. Who is this God? Is this Joseph's son? So start reading some other questions. Finally, hostility. Who in the world is this guy? And then finally, they get murderous rage. And the story ends, can you believe it, with Jesus being dragged to a cliff, threatened to be thrown over, killed, but somehow he escapes from that. Now, Jesus himself makes two provocative statements here. Jesus can be rather provocative. When they started questioning him, what does he do? He gives them two examples of how God has chosen people who are not Israelites. He's gone outside to Gentile. One is the story of Naaman, a Syrian. Today, Syrians and Israelites don't get along too well, but it was true back in the first century. The other is the widow at Zarephath, another non-Israelite town. So we have here Jesus provoking, perhaps, also the people to respond when he makes a bold claim, I am fulfilling what you find here in Scripture. Okay. Now, let's look a little more at the Jesus that Luke is describing here. And again, look at Luke 4, 18 and 19. You want to try to figure out what in the world Jesus is claiming here. The text talks about this Spirit-anointed proclaimer of good news to the poor. The role of the Spirit is very important in Luke Acts. Jesus is the one. From his baptism and on, he's anointed by the Spirit. Okay? So everything Jesus does in the first vial is done under the authority and power of the Spirit. His words, his deeds, his preaching about the kingdom, finally even his death. So all under the role of the Spirit. And then you know the book of Acts as equally under the power of the Spirit. In fact, a better name for the book of Acts would be what? Acts of the Holy Spirit. And commentators will say time and again. I'm going to have to take a little watch here. So here, Jesus is the Spirit-anointed proclaimer of good news in the Gospel and the book of Acts, the role of the Holy Spirit in bringing the word of Jesus to the nation. Now, let's look a little more closely at this quotation from Isaiah 61:1-2, and as I said, 58:6. How should we interpret this text? And the question, the debate is, when Jesus says, I'm fulfilling this text, does he mean it symbolically or literally? Good news to the poor. Isaiah 61:1-2. Here the prophet announces the good news that God's about to set the people free from their captivity and exile. And he promises their return and restoration. So it's a message of hope for oppressed people. They're in exile. Luther is going to say some more about this, in his sessions. Okay, good. So here, it's a word of hope to people who are in exile. Then, another thing that might be involved here is the Jubilee year imagery. The prophet uses the language of the Jubilee year when he talks about the acceptable year of the Lord. Acceptable year of the Lord. And you know what the Jubilee was? Let me just go with the Jubilee year. Because the sabbatical year, and then Jubilee is one more thing. On the year of Jubilee, all debts were canceled. That's the 50th year. All debts were canceled. All slaves were free. There was to be a sabbatical year, a fallow year, no crops. And the new thing about the Jubilee is what? The land is to be returned to its original owner. It's in Leviticus 25 and other places in the Old Testament. Wow. Was Jesus proclaiming a new Jubilee year? There are a couple of good scholars. John Howard Yoder is one of them. He wrote The Politics of Jesus, who argues, yeah. What Jesus was saying is, we have now, with my coming, a new Jubilee year. I don't think so. Most of us think that Jesus was not saying a new Jubilee year was here. Rather, he's using that imagery to teach something else about his own work and teaching and the kingdom. And I'm going to say more about that as time goes on. So I don't think Jesus is saying, with my coming now, a new Jubilee year is here in a literal sense. But in a symbolic sense, the Jubilee image teaches something about social justice, about taking care of the poor, about, you know, all the kinds of things that Jesus was concerned about in reaching out to those who are the poor and the needy. So I can hear it here, but not as a kind of literal interpretation. Well, okay, so much for this Luke 4. Let me just stop. Any questions or comments on just what I'm telling you about here, about this opening text in the Gospel of Luke? Any questions or comments? No? Okay. Let's go on. Now, here's my question. Who are these poor in the Gospel? Who are these poor? And what's the good news to these poor? And now I'm going to argue that the poor that Luke is thinking about are literally the poor and needy. There's always an attempt to spiritualize everything, isn't there? To say, well, the poor are really those who are poor in spirit or poor in other kinds of ways. And my argument in my book, and I think it's been sustained, is that when Luke talks about the poor here, based on this text from Isaiah, he literally means those who are poor and needy and so forth. Okay, what's the evidence for that in the book in the Gospel? First of all, look at chapter 7, 18 to 23. Interesting text here. Go and tell John, chapter 7, 18 to 23. When you look at that, we won't have to read it, but I'll just again recap for you what that's all about. John the Baptist, this is a guy who baptizes Jesus. One is Jesus the Messiah? And we've always speculated along, why does he? Why is he uncertain? I think I have a good answer, but I won't share with you right now. He's certainly confused about this Jesus. And I think it has to do with the fact that Jesus is not preaching judgment. He's offering good news. He's offering grace. So John sends two disciples to ask, you know, are you the ones to come? Or do you have to look for someone else? And it's in this that we get the answer of Jesus. How does Jesus answer? He first heals the sick, gives sight to the blind, and ends up by saying he has proclaimed good news to the poor. Just read, someone read verse 22, 7:22. And we'll see, read 7:22.
And he answered them, "Go and tell John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have good news brought to them."
Where did that come from? That's where we found in Luke 4, 60, Isaiah 61. So here clearly, in Luke, Jesus is answering who he is by pointing to this text in Isaiah. Okay? He's come here to bring good news to the poor, and I said, blind, and so forth. So yes, clearly, for Luke now, Jesus is in fulfillment of this hope based on Isaiah 61. Poor have good news preached to them. And so Jesus' words and deeds are messianic signs of the kingdom's presence in Jesus. So who are the poor here? Who are the poor here? Who are they? They're the sick, the suffering, and the poor. There's nothing symbolic about this at all. Okay. So I really hear them. The poor are the people in need. Okay. That's what Luke, Jesus, is reaching out to. Those of the poor. Or another good text. Look at chapter 14. In chapter 14, in chapter 14, Jesus is in conversation with some Pharisees and others, and in verses 12 to 14, Jesus tells his host, the Pharisee who was hosting him, regarding the people he should be inviting to his feast. And he does it by telling him whom not to invite. Don't invite your friends, your family, your rich neighbors. Okay, that's what we normally would do. But why not? Well, they can always return the invitation. That's just reciprocity. Okay? But what are you supposed to do? Well, somebody read here. I think it's verse 13.
"But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind."
Well, where'd that come from? Same text, Isaiah 61, 1-2, 58-6. The same text Jesus used here when he was answering John. Am I the Messiah or not? And who are these poor? Clearly there are those in need. Okay. It's very literal, understanding who these poor are. Or one other text here in chapter 14. The parable of the grain dinner, we call. It's in chapter 15, verse 15 through 24. Chapter 14, 15 through 24. We don't have to read the whole parable of the great dinner. And it's Luke who alone names those who are invited the second time. Have someone read verse 21, please.
"So the slave returned and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and said to the slave, 'Go out at once into the streets and lanes of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame.'"
All right. What are they? The poor and the needy, okay? Very literal here, understanding of the fulfillment of this text here. Okay, we have this again, coming from Isaiah 61, 1-2, where, again, we seem to are We're certainly being told that the poor and the needy are those to Jesus is sent. Okay, now, what another text? Again, try and explore who are the poor in Luke Acts. Look at chapter 6, 20 to 23. Chapter 6, 20 to 23. This is Luke's sermon on the plain. There are two sermons in Luke. One sermon in Luke, but there's another one in Matthew. But what I'm trying to show here is how Luke's sermon is somewhat different from Matthew's sermon. And particularly in our question of who are these poor that Luke is trying to introduce us to. We have here both sermons. Luke's sermon and Matthew's sermon begin with the Beatitudes. But look at the Luke of Beatitudes, how different they are from the Matthean Beatitudes. What we have here in the Luke of Beatitude are blessings to poor, hungry, weeping, persecuted. Wow. There's no poor in spirit, as when you go to Matthew. There's no hungry and thirsty for righteousness, as you find in Matthew. No, in Luke, it's clearly, literally, the poor, the hungry, the suffering, and also the persecuted here. So, what we have is what we say, no spiritual distinction of the poor in Luke's gospel. These are literally those who are the poor and the needy. And that, again, I think is consistent with what we find throughout Luke's gospel. Now, also look at verses 24 to 26. Luke and wolves. We have Luke, the Beatitudes, he's blessed the poor, the hungry, the needy, the persecuted. And then here in the wolves, who are these wolves addressed against? Well, they're addressed against those who are rich and have everything they need and so forth. Okay? So you've got quite a different description of the group to whom Jesus is addressing his message here in the Gospel of Luke. So we have again here, my attempt to show you that for Luke, the poor are literally the poor, the needy, those who are really in need. And Jesus is the Spirit anointed proclaimer of good news to these poor again. So I think that is so truthful here. Now, let me say something a little more. Who are the poor and the needy in Jesus' time? Well, it's interesting. When Luke mentions the poor, the crippled and blind, and the lame, the lepers, and the possessed, most of these people lived on the margins of society. Let me illustrate. Lepers were outcasts. They couldn't be a part of the normal community. Blind, deaf, and dumb are forbidden from the temple. Can't go into the temple. Widows, they've been great deed, and so widows and orphans and strangers are always a part of the class of people who are in greatest need. So Luke is now picking up on what was different, what was true in his time, naming those who needed help were the lepers, the blind, deaf, and dumb, and even widows. So again, the good news is being proclaimed to literally people who are in great need. Okay. So again, I'm just trying to hear Luke. Who are these poor? And here they are, those who are really in need. Now, let's look a little more at some other things. I'm going to now look a little bit at the birth stories in the Gospel of Yesterday.
Is there a difference between the word proclaim and the word bring? In the I'm reading from the New Revised Standard Version, and Isaiah and Luke has the word he brings good news to the poor, both in Isaiah and Luke.
Yeah.
And
same Greek word is there. So you're just dealing with translations.
Oh.
And I guess it meant the I don't remember what the Greek word is, but the same Greek word. So you can have four different translations of the word. So I don't think there's any difference.
I was just noticing this for the first time in the series of blesseds and the series of woes. The last woe is woe to you when all men speak well of you. And then back in verse 22 in chapter 4, all spoke well of him and were amazed at his gracious words. I'm just wondering if Jesus was one of those who felt the woe after all spoke well of him.
That's a good comment. Yeah, maybe that's what Luke sort of wants to bring up. Yeah, is he right? They really get after it. He's one of the persecuted very, very soon there. Yeah, good. I'm not sure, but yeah, that looks to me, it makes some sense. Any other comments, questions? Okay, let's look at the Luke and birth narratives, Luke and birth story. And here, I think I also find this theme of good news to the poor in a very literal sense of the word. Give you a couple of examples. In chapter 1, Luke models two pairs of male and female Jewish saints. Male and female. I love the way Luke always pairs men and women together. It's just such a wonderful gospel. It's the only gospel also that has a woman represented as God. In Luke 15, we'll get into that too later. So here we have these two pairs of saints. We have first Zechariah and Elizabeth. Okay, where the priest had these waiting for, he heard the word of the angel that he was going to be given birth to the son, but he has trouble accepting it, so he's made deaf. But look at how Zechariah and Elizabeth are described in verse 6. Look at chapter 1, verse 6. What are they called? What do you read? Chapter 1, verse 6. You don't have it?
Righteous.
Okay, righteous and blameless. That means they are pious. These are devout, really are. Okay, these are born to the religiously devout people in the time. Now, as a priest, he was a member of the lower class. Priests were not upper class, as we often think. Only high priests were upper class. They were very upper class. But the priests, there were thousands of priests. Some lived in Jericho, some lived in Jerusalem, but they barely survived. And they didn't have full-time jobs. There were too many priests, so they could work about one-third of the year. So it was not easy. They didn't have probably wives who were teachers to help them out or whatever, but it was not easy. Big priest.
Poor preachers.
What?
They're just poor preachers.
Yeah, that's not bad. That's good. Poor preachers. Okay. But here, the other couple, Simeon and Anna. And look at them. Simeon. Chapter 2 now. Chapter 2, verse 25. How does Luke describe them? Verse 25.
Righteous and devout.
Okay, same words exactly as for Zechariah. And then Simeon, we don't know what his vocation was. We're not told. He's a priest, I think so. We don't really know. But Anna, look at righteous Anna, beautiful Anna. And how is she described? Chapter 2, verse 38. What? Again, same words, righteous, devout. She is a widow. As a widow, however, she brought not to the gospel who are really in need. The widows, orphans, and strangers are usually the ones who are most in need in the first century in our Old Testament. Now, my point is here. Both of these models of male and female Jewish piety, we catch a glimpse of the pious poor who need to wait upon God for all their needs. These are really those who are in most need. Okay, now, one other figure in the birth story, she is one. In Matthew's birth story, who is center? Joseph. But in Luke's birth stories, Mary is always the key figure here. And she's, for two chapters, she really dominates what's going on here. Now for Luke, commentators agree that she is the example par excellence of people who believe in God, who trust in God. Okay? And we see that when she is her response, when the angel announces the birth of Jesus, she is described, look in chapter 1, verse 38. Somebody read that, chapter 1, verse 38. What she described as?
I am the Lord's servant, Mary answered. May it be to me as you have said. Right. The angel left.
Wow, she's just received this announcement of her role, and she, I am the Lord's servant. And then she accepts it. Oh, look at verse 45.
And blessed is she who believed that there would be a fulfillment of what was spoken to her by the Lord.
Okay, in each case, she is a symbol of a believer, the one who trusts, the one who accepts, the one who is willing to be whatever God has chosen her to be. Now, so how does Mary describe herself? She finally describes herself here in verse 38 with the Greek word doule. You know what that means? Doulos, doule, slave or servant. Translation will say handmaiden or something like that. The literal meaning is really slave. Doulos, or servant. So that's again her self-understanding is that of a humble, lowly person who simply has to trust and believe in God. Dule, God's dule. Now, the other thing I want to say about Mary is this great hymn that's attributed to her, what we call the Magnificat. Now, Holden really has, Marty Hong is gorgeous, Magnificat. It's really captured, you know, this whole sense of what the Magnificat is about. And it'll be fun to sing it, but we won't have to sing it now. We'll get enough more chances to do that. This great hymn is described to Mary. Some scholars doubt whether it was Mary. Some figure was maybe Elizabeth, who spoke, but we won't get into that scholarly argument. I think it's Mary. Okay, doesn't matter. Now, what is this about? In the first half of this Magnificat, Mary marvels. Why in the world did God choose me? Who am I? I'm not the high priest's daughter. I'm not of a noble class. I have no reason for being chosen. And yet, yeah, God chose her. Okay? Wow, I can't back it. No understanding, just don't know why. And the second half of the hymn is a punchline. This is the way God always acts. God always chooses the lowly and exalts. He chooses the lowly and puts down the mighty. Okay? God is always on the side of the poor and the oppressed. Yeah. He always takes, puts down those who think they are so good. So this is the way God is. God always acts on behalf of those who are in need. Yeah? So this powerful Magnificat God preaches those two sermons. The surprise of being an instrument of God, and secondly, wow, this is the way God always acts. He takes the side of those who need it the most. Now, I have run across a beautiful description of the understanding of who this Mary is. And this description of who Mary is comes out of a book by Robert McAfee Brown. And I don't know if any of you know him, but he was a scholar, theologian at Stanford. Stanford, of all places, had theologians. Okay, that's pretty good. But he always on the side of ethics. And in particular, he took an interest in what we call liberation theology. You know what that is? That's theology dealing with people who live in impoverished areas. And so, Brown shares with us a dialogue between a priest and his parishioners, his people, about who this Mary is. And for Catholics, of course, Mary is who? She's exalted, she wears golden crowns, she's dressed in both beautiful robes. I mean, this is someone you just superwoman if you want to use that kind of word. And yet, we're going to hear a reading here. And Janice is going to read this for us. It's like Mary.
So in this,
if
dialogue...
If you can't hear her, we'll have her come up here.
I can speak up pretty well. In this dialogue, then, there is the priest, and then there is the response by the parishioners. The priest. Today is September 12th. Does that date mean anything special to you? The response. 3 years ago today, Allende was killed in Chile, and the Chileans lost their leader. Now they are suffering repression. Another response. Allende's death makes me think of the death of Martin Luther King. The priest. Why do you think of the deaths of those two together? The response. Because both of them were concerned about oppressed peoples. The priest. Doesn't the day mean anything but death to you? The response. Well, today is also the feast of the Holy Name of Mary. So this day also makes me think of her. The priest. Is there any connection between Allende and Martin Luther King and Mary? The response. I guess it would depend on whether Mary was concerned about oppressed peoples too. The priest. Let me read part of Mary's song, the Magnificat, in the beginning of Luke's gospel. God has scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts, put down the mighty from their thrones, and exalted those of low degree. He has filled the hungry with good things, and the rich has sent empty away. Response. Bravo! But, Father, that doesn't sound at all like the Mary we hear about in the cathedral. And the Mary in the holy pictures certainly doesn't look like a person who would talk that way. The priest. Tell us about Mary in the holy pictures. The response displayed in one of those pictures. Here she is. She is standing on a crescent moon. She is wearing a crown. She has rings on her fingers. She has a blue robe embroidered with gold. The priest. That does sound like a different Mary from the Mary of the song. Do you think the picture has betrayed the Mary of the song? The response. The Mary who said that God has exalted those of low degree would not have left all of her friends so she could stand on the moon. The corporate response, take her off the moon. Another response, the Mary who said that God has put down the mighty from their thrones would not be wearing a crown. A corporate response, take off her crown. Another response, the Mary who said that God has sent the rich empty away would not be wearing rings on her fingers. The corporate response, take off her rings. Another response, the Mary who said that God has filled the hungry with good things would not have left people who were still hungry to wear a silk robe embroidered with gold. The corporate response, take off her robe. And then an anguished response, but Father, this is not right. We're doing a striptease of the Virgin. The priest, very well, if you don't like the way Mary looks in this picture, what do you think the Mary of the song would look like? A response, the Mary of the song would not be standing on the moon. She would be standing in the dirt and dust where we stand. Another response, the Mary of the song would not be wearing a crown. She would have an old hat like the rest of us to keep the sun from causing her to faint. Another response, the Mary of the song would not be wearing jeweled rings on her fingers. She would have rough hands, just like ours. Another response, the Mary of the song would not be wearing a silk robe embroidered with gold. She would be wearing old clothes like the rest of us. And then an embarrassed response. Father, it may be awful to say this, but it sounds as though Mary would look just like me. My feet are dirty, my hat is old, my hands are rough, my clothes are torn. The priest, no, I don't think it is awful to say that. I think the Mary you have all described is more like the Mary of the Bible than the Mary we hear about in the cathedral and see in all the holy pictures. The response, I think she'd be more at home here in the slum with us than in the cathedral or the general's mansion. Another response, I think her message is more hopeful for us than for them. They are mighty and rich, but she tells them that God puts down the mighty from their thrones and sends the rich away empty. Another response, and we are at the bottom of the heap and very hungry, but she tells us that God exalts those of low degree and fills the hungry with good things. The priest, now let's see, how could we begin to help God bring those things to pass?
Thank you. What do you think? Hit the nail on the head? Huh? Any response? What did you think when you read it?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going, let's think about this in a different way. And those that we, you know, because even Christ, we sometimes, I mean, in our holy pictures, looks pretty good, you know, rather than being right down there with the dirty. And even if you see him in pictures of Christ in ministry, you don't see the dirty and the, you know, the...
He always looks more Norwegian.
That too.
That's only if you have Norwegian eyes.
So
German eyes see it differently.
So we'd like to see him as something rather than just...
Well, he also does not appear as a carpenter of the time, as his profession, because he would have been going out to get the wood. And unfortunately, in his day, they didn't have power tools to work the wood, so he would be... You know, I mean, he would be equivalently muscular and brawny as the fisherman you know, who were hauling the nets out by him. And most of the picture, very few of the pictures depict a Christ who is, you know, a working class person.
Good.
I was going to say, though, too, that having read and enjoyed Walt Longren's Book of God and reading about Mary and the whole thing in that context, and having this real sense of very common people, you know, very earthy people, I think gave me a better slant on that.
Any other comments? I spent a semester of teaching in Africa, South Africa, a couple years ago. And the Jesus there and the Christ and Mary there are much closer to what we're hearing here. One of my, every time we worship in the chapel of South Africa, Umpumulo was the name of it, a Zulu name. It's in KwaZulu-Natal province. Every day we had chapel, in the morning or evening, I usually went once, not twice. But every day we went in, there was a beautiful tapestry. And it was an African Jesus, finally. You know, a black Jesus, African Jesus, sort of South African. I'm sure he was Zulu, they had Zulu homes all the way around. Pictures of the crow, kind of things there. So finally, I understand, this Jesus is not going to find it any one gender or race. He's gold. He belongs to whoever you are. But that was just always hit me so hard. Like this dialogue does here, that the Jesus we want to meet to know is the real Jesus. He's the carpenter or whoever it might be. Okay, any other comments? Did you like it? I can really grasp a little bit closer, a little bit more about Mary and Jesus. Now, one other point here. In the Magnificat, Luke introduces us to another theme that's found throughout the Gospel of Luke, the theme of the reversal, the great reversal. The reversal is that for Luke and Jesus, again, the proud are low, the low are exalted. That's what we mean by reversal. Or, God is on the side of the lowly and against the proud. So, God is the one who's always going to reverse things. And then in the next sessions, we're going to see many places in Luke where this reversal of our roles and our conditions is a part of Jesus' teaching. We're going to have to face the harsh realities, of course, of how do we deal with this in terms of our own positions. Okay, so thank you. Now, a couple of other comments. One other argument for saying for Luke, the poor are literally the poor. Is going to come from all those texts we're going to look at in our following sessions about the rich and the poor. Luke has more texts on the difference between rich and poor or what kinds of stories about the rich and poor than any other of the Gospels. And these texts, if we're going to go through all most of them, will then support, I think, our finding that for poor Luke, the poor always include those who are socially and economically poor. So the announcement of good news to the poor in Jesus' opening sermon at Nazareth, I cannot be spiritualized away. It identified Jesus' ministry with captives and oppressed, the outcasts and the sinners. And that's the kind of Jesus we're going to encounter as we work through the Gospel of Luke. So there are hard social realities here in our understanding of who this Jesus is and what his ministry is to those of us
who are part of his disciples. So, okay. Comments, questions, brother? Okay, let's stop for now. Next session, next time, yes.
There was a question
I had. Oh, I'm sorry, I just can't see.
Well, these stories always pin me.
They what?
They pin me to the wall.
Right till we get to them. We're just going to look at them.
Yeah.
The dangers of wealth, tax, shit. And we have to look at them and be brave as we look at them, but they're not going to be easy. I can't promise you any easy road if you stick lifting. It's going to be not easy. Although there's a way around it. Not around it, there's a way through it, maybe. Better way to say it. Okay, but you, yes?
Well, we are certainly left with designing an alternative lifestyle, or changing the lifestyle that I have, that we have, to give away more of what I have, and I think what we all have, certainly does shape us toward being, toward giving.
Good.
Giving to people in the right places.
Good.
In the right way.
He was trying to fear, steal some of the thunder of what I'm going to be doing. Okay. There's going to be a way where we can make friends with our wealth. Okay. That'll be my fourth lecture.
Great.
Okay, let's take a break.